don't know how to. Okay.
This is the finale. Get it together.
I'm so sorry. It's the finale of season two, and I still don't know what I'm doing, but it's fine. Yes, this is the last episode of season two, and we aren't going to take a break, so we'll be back next week with the first episode of season three. Do you have anything?
No. Email us, actually.
Jump in.
Email us your favorite episode from season two. Shotofcrime@gmail.com.
You can send us your least favorite, too. That'll be interesting.
Tell us everything you hate about us.
This episode.
Give us bullet points on how we can be better.
Yeah, that's fine. I will skip over it all, but it'll be good.
Just do something. I don't know.
Just send us something. Okay, so at the top, today you're doing your story, Bella. Mm-hmm.
Yep, it's at a the long top, one.
Yeah, I have just a little tidbit.
Oh, okay.
It's not enough to do a whole story on. I mean, I guess you could just because of the time period.
Okay.
But I just am going to kind of jump into it. Have you heard about Coco Chanel?
I mean, I've heard of.
So now that with the availability of declassified French government documents, it's been revealed that she did covert work for Nazi military intelligence during World War II.
It's so random.
She was born into poverty in 1883 and was sent to an orphanage at 12 and then kind of climbed her way up. And yeah, she did. She was close to people in the like Nazi affiliates. And she, the only reason she didn't go to prison is because of Winston Churchill.
Why?
Because he like basically had connections and made sure she didn't get prosecuted.
That is so random.
Yeah, so if you're sporting that Coco Chanel.
Yeah, I don't got enough money for that. We don't get paid enough for this.
Sponsored by Coco Chanel.
Imagine if we had merch at some point.
Don't sue me for defamation. This is online. You can find it. I'm just quoting it.
Okay, if we had merch and like a shirt, what would our shirt say?
We can't afford Coco Chanel. I don't know. I'm trying to think of quotes.
We gotta be ready for our fame.
Our merch store? Mm-hmm. Don't sue me for defamation. Definitely be at least a keychain.
It should be like
a mace.
I know like I'm pronouncing this wrong. That's literally the theme of all of our episodes.
I'm not sure how you say this.
We say everything wrong. Actually, though, for my story, oh shoot, I should have probably refreshed it because when I was doing it, there were some like names that I did not know how to pronounce and I looked them up and I had it, but I should probably refresh before I start my story.
Yeah, maybe. Whatever. But yeah, I feel like in that time period, there might be some interesting people that you don't know that we look to now.
You might be able to like get a bigger story on that.
Yeah, I was looking into it. So from the little bit that I looked into, like she also had connections with Pablo Picasso. So I don't know if he had connections with Nazis. It's very like...
like that everybody connected.
Basically, a lot of people in like the elite wealthy world had connections with Nazis back
then.
Interesting. So it kind of makes you like
A lot of it is probably very secretive too.
Yeah, but they're uncovering a lot of that stuff.
That's
now.
Crazy. Huh, yep. Interesting.
Yep. So that's my little I was going to talk about Armie Hammer, but that's a lot. And I was like, I could potentially do a whole story on this.
That might be interesting.
Yeah, I'm kind of waiting till there's a little bit more information because it's kind of in the middle of it.
But I get that.
Yeah, that's my little little tidbit.
Nice.
Sweet. Let's jump into your story.
All right, so.
Wait, before you start, I did remember one more thing. There's a book called Sleeping with the Enemy that's kind of goes.
Who
more
was it
depth.
Written by?
I don't know. I didn't write that down.
Like, I wonder where they got so all their sorry. Information. Well, that's something Jane could look up, probably.
Probably just old documents that weren't available to the public before. But I think actually, Jan, if you don't mind looking it up, because I read it really quickly. I don't know if it's a book or a movie or what it is, but if you can tell us at the end and then who it's by.
Thanks. And what kind of connection they had.
Yeah, and like what their sign is, what their social security number is.
He's over it. Literally ignored us. All right, so I got a long story for us today, and it is based in Italy. I did look up how to say certain names because I was like, oh, shoot, this is going to be a hard one. So this story is about Yara Gamiracio.
Oh, that was really pretty.
Thanks.
I feel like your Portuguese background. Yeah, are there certain Italian things you say that remind me? Yeah.
I've like watched some like movies where they speak Italian for a little bit, and I purposely don't look at the subtitles, and I can like kind of understand it. So it's very similar.
Oh, that's cool. But.
So, okay. So Yara should only have been gone a short while. On Friday, November 26, 2010, at 5:15 p.m., she left home to go to the gym, just a few hundred meters from her home. Yara, who was 13 and wore train track braces, was preparing for her rhythmic gymnastics show the following Sunday. All she needed to do was drop off a stereo with her instructor. She said goodbye to her family, who knew where she was going, and left the house. By 7 p.m., Yara had still not come home, and her parents were becoming anxious. The town where they lived, did not look up city.
Go for it.
Brembate di Sopra was a quiet place. Nice. On the so-called Bergamasque Island.
Okay, that was a little bit more like how I would say it.
And it was an hour north of Milan, which I feel like is one of the cities that everyone knows.
Yeah, we got that one.
But the town has a population of 8,000. It has quiet streets and it's lined with poplars and cypresses. You can see the wooded mountains in the distance. At 7:11 p.m., Yara's mother phoned her daughter, but the call went straight to voicemail. 20 minutes later, Yara's father called the police. The call was put through to the public prosecutor's office in the center of the provincial capital, Bergamo, a city about 7 miles east of her town. The magistrate, which is just kind of like the person in charge of the police department, whatever, on duty was called Letizia Ruggeri. She was 45 and a tough former policewoman who had earned her stripes fighting Cosa Nostra in Sicily. She had been a magistrate for almost 15 years and knew what needed to be done. Within minutes, she had dispatched both state police officers and Carabinieri, which is basically their military police, to her to Yara's town. Which this lady, like, I love her so much. She's such a badass in the best way possible.
So my first question is, if I heard you correctly, the girl, the 13-year-old, what's her name?
Yara.
Mm-hmm. Didn't answer her phone once, and they've done all of this already?
I think to them it was very clear, like, that's not something that she would usually do, and she was supposed to be home by then. But I also think, like, maybe Italian police are a little bit more, like, on it.
Well, and it's a small town, so they may not have been doing much else. Like, to be fair, it's like, you're kind of comparing apples and oranges if you're going to compare it to America.
Yeah.
But I'm just impressed with how, like, it's right? Like,
oh, there's lots of like things, especially that like this lady did, the like chief woman or whatever that she did, that I was like, holy cow. Like, she's really on it.
On
like
it.
It's very impressive, but yeah, I'll get to that.
No, I mean, I was trying to compare it to how I feel like they would handle it in America. And that would be like a 48-hour process.
Yeah. Or more.
Best case scenario.
Literally, yeah.
Unless you had some kind of connections or
whatever. Well, and maybe they did. I didn't see anything about that, but yeah, wow. It was a pretty fast turnaround.
That's impressive.
Yep. So Yara's gym instructor confirmed that she had seen the teenager earlier that day and that she had done some light training before heading off. The police quickly established that the last known contact with Yara was a text message she had sent to a friend, Martina, at 6:44 p.m. She was agreeing to meet at 8 a.m. the following Sunday. That was the last anyone heard from her. The gym that she was last seen at was part of a large sports complex. It was a building with many entrances and exits, and a few people said they'd seen two men, possibly in conversation with Yara. They were standing near a red car, but there was not too much like to go off of. They didn't have much information on that.
Mm-hmm.
So Letizia, the cop, called in tracker dogs. Instead of following the expected route back to Yara's home, Letizia's dogs went in the opposite direction towards a small hamlet, which is just a small like town, it's almost like a village, nearby called Mapello. When the team analyzed the last signals from Yara's mobile phone, the results showed that it had been registered as present in Mapello at 6:49 that evening. So that was like the last tracking from her phone.
Hmm.
Everything seemed to point away from Yara's family, but investigations of this type always start at home. Right. Over the next few days, Leticia and her team questioned every member of the Gamiracio family, looking for signs of discord or dark secrets. Yara's parents were well known and respected, so I guess maybe they might have had connections if they were well known. Her father, Fulvio,
was in a place with only 8,000 people, though, you probably have a lot more people that are well known.
Yeah, yeah.
Smaller.
That's true. So her father, Fulvio, was an architect whose father had been the local postman. And Mara, Fulvio's wife, was a teacher in Longuelo, a nearby town. Their marriage appeared strong. They had 4 children. Yara had an older sister, Kiba. She was 15. Mm-hmm. And 2 younger brothers, Nathan and Joel, both under 10. So they looked into parents' family, like, fully through it and didn't find anything weird or things like that. Leticia then put wiretaps on hundreds of phones. Like, there's just so many little things that she did that was like, yo, you really went the extra mile. So she put wiretaps on hundreds of phones. Her team also tried to trace the owners of all the handsets, which was about 15,000, which had passed through Mapello on the day of Yara's disappearance. Like, that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
All the phones that had passed through that small town, 15,000.
Like, every second wasted, you're losing information. So the fact that she's acting quickly helps a ton.
Oh, yeah, for sure. One of these belonged to a Moroccan man called Mohamed Fikri. In one wiretapped conversation in late November, the interpreter heard the phrase, quote, "Forgive me, God, I didn't kill her," end quote. Fikri had been working in a builder's yard in Mapello, but by the time investigators had put the pieces together, a few days later, he was on a boat bound for Tangiers. I don't know where that is. Maybe you could look that up. It's Tangiers. On December 4th, Italian authorities intercepted the vessel and arrested Fikri. They searched the van he had been using and discovered that it contained a blood-stained mattress. Leticia said, quote, "People liked him as the guilty party because he was foreign." But Fikri was quickly cleared. The phrase had been mistranslated and the blood was extraneous to the investigation. I didn't really look in too much into that. Like, I don't know if they found out, like, what it was.
It's not related.
No, it's not related. This is just a weird man. And I don't know if he got, like...
Well, and if they look at it and it's, like, his blood or there's or some random explanation, then...
If he's, yeah.
It doesn't really matter, you know.
Exactly. But a lot of people were like, oh, we really like this for the guy because he was foreign. And it was like, he's not part of our small town, so he must be the bad guy.
He's an outsider and there's something bloody in his, you know.
Yeah, and he was just weird.
That's a easy conclusion.
Exactly. As autumn slipped into winter, Brembate di Sopra, which is her town, found itself at the center of a mystery which had captured the country. The Gambirasio family were horrified by the sudden glare of publicity. They were very, like, private. Like, they didn't like to be the center of attention. Like, they just liked to have their home life very private. So they were not used to that. TV cameras became a permanent fixture in their quiet cul-de-sac. The family locked themselves away, lowering their shutters and even turning down the idea of a torchlight procession to raise awareness. Instead, nuns from the Ursuline order who taught at Yara's school came to pray with Mora, her mom. A mass was held instead of the procession, and the rare statements from the parents were devout pleas for privacy and patience. Which, I get it, like, you're going through this period of, like, we don't know what the heck happened to her, like, we can't even mourn because we don't know.
It's just very dependent, I think, on the personality and how they're grieving. And there's not a right way to do it. Like,
You can't say it's them being cold or like.
Or it's just, yeah, you can't look at somebody and say, "Oh, I would do it differently," because you don't really know
what you would do in that situation. Yeah. So desperate to discover the whereabouts of their daughter, the Gambirasio family did share some photographs of Yara with the press in the days after her disappearance. Yara queuing to take communion, doing the splits in the gym, a studio photo of her in a yellow top and an Italy football shirt on the beach, but no one came forward with any useful information. When her parents finally made a televised appeal a few days after their first Christmas without Yara, they looked awkward. Mora was so uncomfortable she was unintentionally rolling her eyes. Fulvio, who wore a rugby shirt, hesitantly read a plea, quote, "Help us return to normality," end quote. He explained that the family values were love, respect, and honesty, and that they would be giving no more interviews. The whole rolling the eyes thing, like, is a little weird, but it's also, like, she's probably over the whole, like, publicity. Like, I get a small town and everyone being, like, in your face, like, that's a lot.
Some people, like, from personal experience, I look mad all the time when I'm just thinking, you know?
Yeah, it's very dependent, too, on the person. Like, sometimes people just have a certain...
And I, like, we were talking before we started, I sigh when I'm, like... decompressing,
yeah,
and people think I'm upset about something, and I'm genuine. Like, people have different tics, yeah, and so maybe, like, her mom always rolled her eyes, mm-hmm, and she just subconsciously does that.
And if she's very overwhelmed, like, I get that,
yeah,
but
maybe she had something in her eye,
yeah, or that. On the afternoon of February 26, 2011, exactly 3 months after Yara disappeared, a middle-aged man named Yario Scotti was flying his radio-controlled plane in the small town of Cignolo di Sola. It was 6 miles south of Yara's town. Cignolo is surrounded by industrial estates, and the scrubland seemed like a safe, unpopulated place for Scotti to try out his new model aircraft. The model airplane was functioning as Scotti wanted, though, so he brought it down to earth amid the tall weeds. As he picked up his plane, he caught sight of some rags on the ground nearby. At first, he thought someone had been fly tipping, which I don't know what fly tipping is. Does anybody know what that is? Jan's looking it up.
So I just know cow tipping.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know if that's related.
I don't think so. I think it's something completely different. Random. But
so he thought somebody had been fly tipping, and then he saw the shoes. Leticia, the cop, was coming back from a day skiing with her daughter when she got the call that a body had been found. She dropped her daughter at home and went straight to the crime scene. The body was in an advanced state of decomposition. Obviously, it's 3 months after.
Yeah.
But Leticia could see the black bomber jacket with its elasticated waist, which Yara had been wearing when she left home in November.
Mm.
There, too, was her Hello Kitty sweatshirt. Crime scene investigators found Yara's iPod and house keys, as well as the SIM card and battery for her LG phone. The phone itself was missing. Mm. Leticia told reporters later, quote, "It was a relief. Yara's disappearance had really disturbed me. I'm a mother, too, and the only thing worse than the death of a child is the disappearance of a child," end quote. So she, like, she didn't really, like, take a break those 3 months. She was obviously still trying to look for things, but it just, nothing really came from it. So now, once they have that, they're like, okay, now we have more evidence to go off of. We can actually find, like, what happened to her.
Yeah.
So Yara's autopsy was conducted by Italy's most famous forensic pathologist, Professor Cristina Cataneo. A lot of women in the story. They're killing the game.
Yeah.
She discovered traces of lime in Yara's respiratory passages and the presence of jute, a vegetable fiber used to make rope. I know, like, jute rugs, like, it's like that, like,
mm-hmm,
I don't know what it's called. You know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about, but...
It's similar to, like, wicker, kind of. Where did they go? Yara hadn't been raped, although her purple bra was unhooked.
Mm.
She had suffered multiple injuries from a sharp weapon which had pierced her clothing at various points. It seemed that she had been attacked and abandoned. She had died of exposure. That's so sad. The presence of lime and jute suggested the killer might be in the building trade. The forensics team retrieved two DNA samples, one from Giada's phone battery and the other from two fingers of her black gloves, but neither matched any samples the authorities had on record.
Wait. No.
What?
You said building trade?
Yeah, so like he was in like the it would be most commonly those items, like those, like jute and like things that were on her were more commonly in people that were like in that building business. I don't know what that means, but maybe those, like, those materials, I guess, would be somebody that knows their stuff, mm-hmm, when it comes to that kind of stuff. So they couldn't match anything. 2 months later, in April, the commander of the scientific investigations department in Parma phoned Leticia and said, "I've got good news. This murder has a signature. We found male DNA on the underwear of the deceased." It was likely that the murderer had himself been wounded in the struggle, leaving his DNA on the girl's underwear. Leticia and her team named the murder suspect Ignoto One, which means unknown one.
Okay.
Now the hunt for Giada's killer could begin. And that'll be referred to at the throughout the story, Ignoto 1 is unknown. The workload was huge, and Leticia divided up the duties. The police were responsible for taking DNA samples from family members, from school friends, and people in the gym. And the Italian police concentrated on the phone records, cross-referencing all the mobile phones that had moved from her town to Cignolo di Sola on November 26, 2010. Each phone user whose number appeared in both cells was tracked down and asked for a DNA sample. Like, this girl's really on it.
Well, and that's smart, too, because you're not just accusing someone.
No, it's, like, phone records and, like, things that are being, like, traced.
Yeah.
That's really smart.
Like, you have something you're going off of, but you're not just saying, like, oh, the phone records say this. You're actually taking the extra step to get a DNA sample.
And I feel like first she did a good job of, like, delegating. Like, she's literally like, you guys are going to do this. You guys are going to do this. I feel like for a woman, that's rare. And then also, like, this is a very tedious job, but I feel like a lot of, like, stories we've seen, it's been like, nah, we don't really want to do, like, more work. And it's like, this might not come in, like, there might not come anything out of it. The other thing is,
all of those DNA tests are expensive, and that's why we don't do that a lot here,
even though we should. And maybe it's different, like, there, but
the tests will still be expensive no matter where they are, because the labs themselves that process them, it's just expensive. But some jurisdictions are more willing to, like,
actually
put like the budget for that.
Yeah.
So that's why you'll have cases that go cold, because they don't want to spend any more money on testing.
It's just sad. Because you could probably find, like...
Yeah, the show Cold Case Files, that's a lot of what they did. They'd go in...
Oh, really?
And they would fund the testing that just was stopped. Cool. Yeah. And they solved a few cases.
I mean, I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. Like, when you go more into it, into details, you're going to find out more stuff.
Yeah, like evidence that never was processed, because it takes money to process evidence.
That sucks. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they did this whole thing. It was slow and laborious work, obviously, like we just talked about. Mm-hmm. It took geneticists in Parma, Pavia, and Rome a minimum of 6 hours to transform just a few samples of DNA into something which could be read and compared on a computer screen. The cost in machinery and manpower was immense, and the investigation would go on to become one of the most expensive manhunts in Italian history.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yada's funeral took place on a hot morning in late May of 2011. The ceremony took place in the sports hall where she had spent so many hours training and where she had last been seen alive. Outside, a large crowd watched the funeral on a giant screen and heard the condolences of Giorgio Napolitano, the president of the Republic. That's, like, pretty, like, the fact that the president was there, it's like, it was a big deal. By the time of the funeral, investigators had taken thousands of DNA samples, but they still had no leads. Close to the scrubland where Giada's body was found was a nightclub called Sabbi Mobili, which stands for quicksand. Leticia knew that murderers tend to dump bodies in areas with which they're very familiar. So although it seemed like a long shot, in spring of 2011, investigators started taking DNA samples outside the club on busy Fridays and Saturdays. That's crazy. And imagine, like, showing up to the club, let me get your DNA. Like, that's crazy. That's crazy that they took that kind of...
Well, and I wonder if their standard for DNA testing someone is different than here. Like, here you would either do, like, a trash haul or something, or if you were approaching someone, like, you'd have to get their permission.
I'm sure they got their permission.
Yeah, it seems more like they're just, like, kind of saying, like, hey, give me a, like, we're doing DNA tests. And people probably just comply.
Yeah, that's true.
Here, they're probably more hesitant.
Like, what the?
You know, like, they might be like, no.
Yeah, I could
see that. But if everyone works together in a society and it's like,
unless they're all, like, drunk and they're like, I don't know. Like,
they go in after they're intoxicated.
they take all the bottles that were used.
Yeah. It's just interesting.
Very interesting.
Because there's been cases where I'm like, that are in America where I wish they could just make people give DNA.
Yeah, yeah. You'd probably find much more information
out. Yeah.
So that club had a reputation for violence, and there was a young man from the Dominican Republic that had been murdered outside its doors on January 16th of 2011, but the club had helpful records, so it had a reputation. Clubbers required a membership card to get in, and so the authorities could easily track down anyone who went there regularly. Leticia finally got a break. One of the samples from the club seemed strikingly similar to the suspect, Ignoto 1. The man who had gave the sample was called Damiano... I wrote, like, the like pronunciation
yeah
next to it. Guriani.
If you just say it with confidence, I will just believe you.
Damiano Guirani. It literally sounds like a plate, like a dish. He was quickly excluded as a suspect. He had been in South America on the day of Giada's disappearance. But geneticists were convinced he was a close relative of the murderer. Letizia said, "We were all very excited. We said, bingo, just a couple of more days and we'll have the murderer." As Letizia and her team put together the jigsaw of Guirinoni's family, they made an astonishing discovery.
Related to her.
To the cop?
No, to Yara.
Oh, no. Damiano's mother, Aurora Zani, had worked for 10 years as a domestic help in the Gambirasio home, so in Yara's home. She lived nearby and had gone to Yara's home twice a week throughout the young girl's childhood. Zani was a middle-aged woman who was very attached to her employers. She recalled how Yara would always ask her to watch her latest gymnastics moves, and Zani would tell her to be careful not to hurt herself. In 2011, she was no longer working for the family, but said her relationship with Yara's parents was excellent. To find herself at the center of the investigation was To find herself at the center of the investigation into Yara's murder was, Zani said later, the worst thing that could have happened to me. Letizia said, "Obviously, we intercepted Damiano and his mom Zani's calls, had them follow. We grilled them and tortured them in the sense that we pressed them. It was only after months of close surveillance that Letizia, in the summer of 2011, resigned herself to the fact that it was just a crazy coincidence. There was no connection," she says. "You couldn't make it up. This whole case is crazy." Like, the fact that there was, like, a connection to DNA, and then the mom was like, you would think automatically, like, oh, this has to be it. Like, there's no way that this is a coincidence.
Yeah.
But the way that she was so thorough with everything else, it kind of feels like, okay, well, you definitely did all you could to see if this was a thing.
Right, yeah.
And it feels, you'll see later too, like, I feel like Letizia has, like, a very good, like, she's obviously had experience, but I feel like she has a very, like, accurate gut feeling towards some things.
Like, instinct.
Yeah, where she'll look for the evidence, but a lot of it is like, no, like, this doesn't seem right kind of thing, which this was one of them. Having seemed so close to a resolution, Letizia Seam reluctantly discarded the angle of the domestic help. The only promising lead they still had was the fact that Damiano's DNA was so similar to that of Ignoto 1. A year on from Yara's murder, Letizia's team was now under intense pressure to find the killer. Thousands of people were being DNA tested, and some locals who hadn't been approached for a sample suggested to the press that the investigation was haphazard. Politicians made personal attacks on Letizia. One Northern League politician, Danielle Bellotti, publicly decried her incompetence, writing an open letter in January of 2012 to the Minister of Justice asking for her to be replaced by someone, quote, of proven experience, end quote. That's so annoying. It's like, this woman's doing everything to try to help this family, and you're literally saying she's incompetent?
Yeah, she's done a lot.
People were annoyed that she was kind of going everywhere trying to get people's DNA, but it's like, she's trying to help this family. Okay, but then
that's kind of the opposite argument. Do you want her to do everything she can, or do you want her to not annoy people?
Clearly, like, she isn't incompetent if she's trying to do whatever she can.
The thing is, if you have nothing to hide, like, come take my DNA. Like, I don't have anything to hide. So you know what I mean?
But the fact that, like, a big politician was like, she needs to be replaced. It's like, shut up.
Well, and they're doing everything that they can just because they're not. I saw this explained in a documentary I was watching, and it was like, maybe I've said it on the podcast before, but it was basically explaining, just because they're not finding the answer doesn't mean they're not looking, because every door they open, it's like, no, it's not this, no, it's not that.
And that doesn't mean they're not.
Yeah. Like, everything that they're doing, any of those options could be the right one. They're basically opening a door, and it's like, is it behind this door? Like,
you can't, like, assume that. It's
and if just you put yourself right in it. And that's why there's cases where, you know, 3 months and they find something, a year and they find something, 10 years in, like, it just has to do with, you go based on the information you have, and if you're negligent, that's one thing. But it seems like she's doing a ton of stuff. That's frustrating. Just
annoying. So Letizia filed a lawsuit against Bellotti in April of 2012, taking particular objection to his characterization of her as a person of, quote, low technical and moral profile, end quote. Behind these criticisms of Leticia was a strong undercurrent of sexism, obviously.
Yeah.
What hope was there that this woman could solve such a complex crime? She was unconventional, a single mother with long salt and pepper hair and 5 earrings in her left ear. Aww. She played classical guitar, rode to work on an old Vespa, and had a black belt in karate. This woman's amazing. She's so cool.
I want her to adopt me.
I saw a picture of her. I'll show you later.
Oh, cool.
Leticia felt she was also being targeted because she had decided to drop the case against the Moroccan laborer, Mohamed Fikri, the guy that everyone was like, this should be the guy. Many people thought I had made the wrong decision and they held it against me. The criticism was ferocious. I found it very tough. So sad. Like, it's the same thing that some cops do where they're just like, yep, this is it. We're done here. It's like they wanted her to do that.
And people get mad when people do that, but then they get mad when they don't.
Exactly. Leticia decided to concentrate on the only promising lead she had, the Gironi DNA. Her team spent months recreating the family tree. The investigators had worked out a complete genealogical tree as far back as 1815.
Wow.
With other branches of the family going back as far as 1716. Like, she's doing her homework. Like, she's killing it. The roots of that family tree were in the small village of Gorno. It's only 45 minutes drive north of Bergamo, but it feels like another world. Although only 1,600 people live in Gorno and it seems like a quiet place, according to one former person, the village is, quote, a bit too hot in every sense. Let's say they're a bit promiscuous, end quote.
Oh, jeez.
In 2011, 2 people in Gorno were murdered in unrelated incidents. So it was the family tree brought, like, traced back to a town that had not, like, was not a really good town. Hmm. And it was a small town, too. The same families have been here for centuries, and on the village's war memorial outside the small church, the names of Benedetto and Pietro Gironi are carved into the stone. The Gironi family were nicknamed Infanti, or Infantry. They were considered by everyone to be loyal, strong, even hot-headed. Mm-hmm. Damiano Gironi's father had a brother, Giuseppe, who had died in 1999. Investigators visited Giuseppe's widow in September of 2011 and found 2 stamps he had licked, one in order to validate his driving license and on another on a postcard he had sent to his family. When DNA results came back from that sample, they had another breakthrough. Geneticists were convinced that Giuseppe Gironi was the father of Ignoto I, the suspected murderer. So they're getting like closer and closer to like, okay, we're in the right family. We just gotta find the right person. Letizia's team quickly built up a picture of Giuseppe Gironi and his family. Giuseppe himself was a thick-set man with a rugged face. He had been a bus driver who played the accordion at village festivals. His marriage to Laura Poli had seemed conventional. They had 3 children, a girl and 2 boys. Laura had become a Jehovah's Witness and after her husband's death had moved to a nearby town. Clusone was the town's name. Since Ignoto I was male, investigators concentrated on the sons, Pierpaolo and Diego. Pierpaolo was like his mother, a Jehovah's Witness. Diego had a drug problem. Neither provided a perfect match with Ignoto I, however, neither of them had children. So now they were kind of like, what the heck? Like, we're here, but there's like a dead end. If Ignoto I really was the son of the late Giuseppe Gironi, the only explanation was that somewhere out there was his illegitimate child. Leticia says, quote, it became an investigation within an investigation, end quote. She was now hunting a woman, presumably in middle to old age, who 30 or 40 years ago had had an affair with a married man, now long dead, and given birth to a boy who went on to murder Yara Gabiracio. So now they know, like, okay, it wasn't his, like, children in his family. He had to have had an affair.
Yeah.
So now we have to find this lady who had an affair, which probably back then was also married at the time, and probably, like,
oh yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
whoever the kid she had, like, probably she probably said it wasn't, obviously the affair was her husband. So it's like literally, and it, like, the further they keep digging, it's like more. So there was incomprehension on both sides. The investigation was, by Italian standards, unusually secretive. Locals couldn't understand why police hunting the murder of a 13-year-old girl were taking DNA samples of elderly women. Botticelli. It's weird. It's like, what are you doing? I could
see people from the outside being confused by that.
Exactly. And because it was very secretive, they were like, what the heck is going on? We just want to know. Botticelli, who was a fan of fictional detectives, says that the investigation was lacking the traditional human element. The sort of person who goes into a bar in the village and puts someone at ease so that something slips out. Locals felt there was something cold about this investigation. With its invasive demands for DNA samples, and it was changing the atmosphere in these small communities. People thought, says Botticelli, that the murderer was here amongst us. So there was a sort of not panic, but fear. Because they were being so secretive. They were like, why are they being secretive? They're like, we would rather you
walk into a bar and manipulate us than just keep to yourself and investigate. Yeah,
exactly.
What?
Investigators knew that from the early 1960s onwards, for 2 weeks every May, Giuseppe Gironi used to go to a spa resort called Salus Term, and it was south of Milan, without his wife. Okay. Doom, doom, doom. Perfect time. Throughout the spring of 2012, Leticia's team scoured records and registers, tracking all the women who had stayed in the resort at the same time of the year as Gironi. They searched orphanages and homes for fallen women. They tested single mothers and women who had left the mountains for Lower Bergamo. They came up empty-handed. The woman they were looking for, they realized, was probably neither single nor fallen, but hidden behind the walls of a marriage.
Yeah.
Divorce was only legalized in Italy in 1970. Until that time, many couples had stayed together despite infidelities.
Right.
So even harder to look at now. By the time Leticia was searching for Ignoto's one's mother, Yada's parents had hired their own expert, a freelance geneticist, in order to review the investigation and explain it to them. For almost a year, Giorgio Portera lobbied for the exhumation of Giuseppe Gironi's body from the cemetery in Gorno. Giuseppe was the dad of who they're looking for. He was concerned that investigators had only been able to compare 13 short tandem repeat regions, which are sequences of DNA, with the DNA of Ignoto 1. So confirmation of paternity demands that at least 15 short tandem repeat regions can be compared, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So early March 7th, 2013, workmen chiseled into Gironi's loculo, which is the horizontal slot in a cemetery wall where his coffin was kept, and removed his remains. They were transferred by the police to a hospital in Bergamo for examination before being returned to Gorno just a few hours later. A couple of camera crews and a few villagers watched. When DNA was extracted from his remains, 29 of those regions could be compared. So now it was absolutely certain that Gironi was the father of Ignoto 1.
Yes.
They got way more than they needed. Mm-hmm. As the investigation dragged on through 2013, the public slowly became aware of why a woman was being sought. It became common knowledge that the late Giuseppe Gironi had had a lover and that she was thought to be the mother of the murderer. Long-forgotten infidelities and old suspicions surfaced. This is so interesting. Botticelli laughs as he describes how his journalist discovered 5 illegitimate children in 2 small villages. He said, quote, 5, we could have started a gossip magazine. It was like an open sewer. We were receiving anonymous letters, stories, people telling us about backgrounds and cuckolds, end quote. So, like, as they're discovering this, all the towns are like, oh, no, it's all coming out. Like,
it feels like Game of Thrones where they're finding all these bastards. Interesting.
That sucks for the town. It's like, imagine being that person and it's like, oh, no, they're going to find out. Society, which had always prided itself on its sense of loyalty and traditional Catholicism, suddenly discovered the betrayals in its midst. Until this point, the investigation had been characterized by cutting-edge scientific analysis. But it was an old-fashioned detective who broke the case open. Marshal Giovanni Massarino was Leticia's right-hand man, working in the office next to hers. Marshall speaks in a light-hearted and formal manner, but he's also, by his own admission, a capitosta, which stands for a stubborn man. He says, quote, I get effed off when I can't solve a case, end quote. Because of this case, he said, I haven't had a holiday for 4 years. So he was also like her personality where he liked to get things done.
Yeah, that. I don't know.
What?
When people say that, it's almost like they want like
But I kind of like that he's the second man. It's like he's not
front. No, I know. Like, I just don't like when people are like, I haven't had a holiday. It's almost like, okay, like a lot of people work hard. I don't know.
I get that. But like this was such a huge case in Italy. It's like he was saying, I think it's better.
It comes across better if someone else is saying that on your behalf and you're not the one saying it.
Yeah, I get that.
To me,
it comes across better. This was also like after the whole case, he was like being interviewed and he was talking about it after everything had been resolved. I don't know if that helps, but
yeah. I mean.
So although Marshall was born in the South near Naples, he had lived in the Bergamo Alps area since 1983, and he had come to know the region well. He reminded them that amid all the gossip about infidelities that had been sparked off by the hunt for Giornoni's lover, a young girl had been killed. By 2013, he knew everything about Giornoni's life. He drove a public bus for the Motellini, which was a bus company. Mm-hmm. In the 1960s and 70s, he would have driven plenty of young women to and from jobs in the various textile factories.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, it was very smart
textile.
Of him.
Textile.
Marshall questioned Giornoni's fellow bus drivers, one of whom had already gone to the press in March 2013, saying that Giornoni had confessed to have gotten a young woman in trouble. Another former colleague described Giornoni as a man with a capital M, implying that he was a womanizer.
Oh.
But it wasn't until June 2014 that one of Marshall's sources finally gave him the name he was looking for. Marshall has always protected his sources and refuses to confirm who first whispered the name of the mystery woman to him. But however it came about, investigators had the final piece of the jigsaw.
Marshall's getting better.
Yeah, I don't think he's this horrible guy.
No, I never thought he was horrible. I just...
I get you.
There's certain things people do, especially in like... the justice system that bother me.
Yeah.
But doesn't mean that they're bad people at all.
Yeah. So he didn't say how
but that's
he got
good.
This,
I like
but
that.
He got the name Esther Arzufi. Mm. Esther had been a neighbor of Giornoni's in Ponte Selva in the late 1960s. In 1966, age 19, she had married Gianni Bossetti from Par, a nearby village. Bossetti was a man whose tough life had turned him inwards. He had been orphaned young and suffered from psoriasis, arthrosis, and depression. Esther seemed very different. An outgoing, good-looking woman, she wore short skirts and dyed her hair. She got a job at the textile factory a few miles away in Villa Diogna, and she took the bus every day. Letizia's team immediately cross-checked the DNA samples they had and discovered that Esther had already been tested in July 2012. They double-checked and realized that a basic error had been made by a geneticist in Rome. Esther's DNA had been compared not to Ignoto once, but to Yara's. Like, what are the odds that they get the DNA of the woman they're looking for?
Human error.
But it was just compared to Yara, not the suspect.
Oh.
That's so frustrating.
Okay. And they were so mad at her for taking so long. And it's like, well, I found the information.
Yeah, the freaking geneticist did it wrong.
Oh.
Yeah. Now investigators hurriedly reran the test and discovered that Esther was indeed the woman they had spent so long looking for.
So Esther was probably sweating when they tested her. And then she's like, oh, I'm good.
She's like, oh, wow.
I'm fine.
That really wasn't his kid. Oh, no. Oh. That's horrible. Esther had left Ponte Selva in 1970, but she had continued her affair with Giornoni. And in the autumn of 1970, she gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl.
Oh.
The boy was called Massimo Bossetti, a slim boy who obviously he had the last name of her husband, not Giornoni.
Right.
He was a slim boy who loved to party. He was nicknamed the animal by his friends. Oh. He was now 42, a builder, married with three children and living in Mapello, the hamlet near Yada's hometown where the last signal from Yada's cell phone had been recorded. Not surprising. Letizia moved fast. On June 15, 2014, she set up a fake roadblock breathalyzing drivers.
Yes.
When her police officers stopped Massimo, they pretended the machine hadn't worked the first time so they could get two good samples. Imagine her being so thorough that she's like, pretend it's not working and have them do it again.
Like, or even if they thought of that on their own and she was just like, do whatever you have to.
Yeah.
Like, I just love the...
How thorough.
How everyone... Because even if she had told them that, some people, you know, just don't try.
They were just
on it. And I love the fact that everyone kind of worked together to like...
Everyone's on the same page.
It was a united force to figure out what happened.
I know. That's this cool. is like rare in the stories we do.
Yeah.
His DNA was immediately sent for overnight tests, and results showed it was an exact match with Ignota 1.
That has to be so hard when you have him in front of you, right? And you're just like, okay, keep going.
Yeah. Leticia wanted to observe Bosetti before arresting him, to study his movements and behavior from a distance. Mm. But she was also worried that the news would get out and that he might leave town. On June 16, Bosetti was arrested and charged with the murder of Yara Gambirasio. The Italian Home Secretary himself released a statement announcing his arrest. Mm. Investigators discovered plenty of circumstantial evidence. Bosetti had frequently hung around Yara's home. He parked his car in Via Don Sala behind the gym and ate at a pizzeria at the end of her road. Mm. He had gone for regular UV showers at a tanning shop nearby. His internet searches were troubling, using search words which implied a compulsion for pubescent young girls. Mm. More pertinently, records suggested that his phone had been present in her town the evening of her disappearance, but had been switched off, conveniently, from 5:45 p.m. until the following morning at 7:34 a.m. For Leticia, the arrest was the reward for almost 4 years of dogged investigative work. After enduring a barrage of criticism for alleged incompetence, she was now celebrated for her brilliance. Massimo Bosetti was sentenced to life in prison. Imagine how, like, for her, it's like, I freaking told you guys it wasn't all these people that you were telling me it was. Like, it was all worth it.
Well, and she's probably so classy that she's just like,
right?
It's fine, we got there. You
yeah.
know? Like,
she probably is. She's really cool.
Lets it roll off her shoulder.
So to end it, while he's being arrested, three families are dealing with the devastation right. of the case. Giordoni's widow has been forced to come to terms with her husband's infidelity and the existence of his other children. Meanwhile, just as he was diagnosed with terminal cancer, Giovanni Bosetti became the nation's most famous cuckold, learning at the same time as the rest of the country that none of his three children are his. Leaks from the investigation revealed that Esther's third child, Fabio, also had a different father. Imagine. The marriage of the accused, Massimo Bosetti, has also come under strain. Since his defense sought to portray him as a family man, two people have come forward to claim that they had affairs with his wife. So both of them were kind of doing other stuff. Such is the local loathing for Bosetti that since his arrest, his twin sister herself coming to terms with both her brother's fate and the fact that the man she thought was her father is not biologically related to her. Her mother, Esther, still denies that she's ever been unfaithful to her husband. You still deny it? Like, okay, they got a literally paternity test.
Here's what I was thinking through, though. If someone's that delusional to, like, stay with that, I wonder if she ever even told him that she was pregnant with this kid. Like, he could have never known.
Oh, that he was the dad? Yeah.
That like, he had a child out there that...
Probably.
You know?
Because she's married. Why would
she
tell
him? I'm
not
saying he wasn't wrong for cheating, but he could... He could have not known that
he had other kids out there.
Right.
I mean, yeah. If she's going to lie and have her husband be the dad.
To the point where, like, you yourself believe the lie.
Because you've
been saying
it for so
long. I feel like that's probably, yeah.
So ridiculous. But the fact that her third child, too, was also from a different father, it's like.
Yeah.
None of them were her husbands.
I think if she just tells herself they're my husbands and she refuses to believe it, then. When she's asked about it, you know, logically she's going to stick to that.
Yeah. She's crazy. They're all crazy. The Gambirasio family, meanwhile, has remained private, recently awarding a gymnastics trophy named after her daughter. Maura wow. Gambirasio struggled to smile and made no public comments. Maura was her mom. Mm-hmm. She's cut her hair short and looks gaunt. Yara is buried between her two grandparents in a cemetery just across the road from her gym. All around the grave are mementos left by her friends. Gym shoes, a metal tulip, rag dolls, plastic angels, and little bracelets. Often in the early evening, you see Yara's father, Fulvio, standing here, gazing at the resting place of his parents and his daughter. Yeah, it's sad. But I'm so glad that they had somebody like Leticia to find justice for them. Because in so many cases we've seen, it's just you don't know.
Yeah. Well, and there's nothing wrong with this, but they seem like they had someone come in and explain it to them, but they seem like they just kind of internalized a lot of it and kind of went into themselves And if they didn't have someone fighting that hard, they might not have ever gotten that closure. You know, mm-hmm. some families have to literally like fight tooth and nail for every bit of information, but they had someone kind of in their corner that did that, which I feel like is really good.
I know. It's really like lucky.
And it's, I mean, it's never like closure, but at least they know, you know?
Yeah. It is in a sense though, because imagine never knowing what happened.
Yeah. It's just never like,
it's never going to be, it's like, it's not going to,
it doesn't make it better, exactly. But
yeah, but at least it's something.
Yeah. Well, and I like the approach that she had towards the case. I feel like could be done more for sure.
Yeah. Just end of the day. I really like Leticia. I was trying to pull up a picture of her so you can see.
That's much better than the cases I have where the investigation, they just decide what it is and don't care.
Look at her frustrated, like in a court. She's so over it.
I love her.
Also, look at her shirt. It's so cute.
Yeah. She's like, I hate these people.
She's just very like spunky and like not what you would normally see in like somebody in charge like that.
Yeah.
But yeah. Rest in peace, Yara.
Hey guys, so this is now my podcast. I've taken over. Season three is all me, baby. we'll be talking about the life of cows. Oh. Oh, I love our cows outside. I named them. Anyways.
One died, actually.
I know. We saw a bunch of circling like vultures, and we were like, no.
I mean, it could be anything, but.
Oh my gosh, that's so sad.
I can hear you, sort of.
Okay, do you remember when you first started giving commentary and it was literally like, so guys, like, I just said that. And you were probably so loud in your headphones, but you were so quiet when you listened to the actual podcast. So I think you could hear him through the headphones.
Okay, cool. Well, great way
anyways, so email us at shotofcrime@gmail.com. This is chaotic. And what did you say? For them to email us
or your favorite season two
episode,
and then you said or your least favorite episode.
Yeah. So email us, and then Steven and Jan are going to give us things they thought of to research during your story.
So just right off the top, I thought of different shirt ideas for you guys.
Ooh.
Top one is I think she did it.
Oh, yeah. Good.
The unofficial
good
motto.
T Swift plug.
Good one.
It's the unofficial motto of the podcast. Sorry if I mispronounce your name. It can be on a shirt. I don't know how to end this. It's always the spouse.
I think that is one of the podcasts. I think that's one of their merch shirts.
Email us.
It's always the spouse.
Email us, please. what were they thinking? And also lazy investigators. I feel like you guys talk about that all the time. And then lastly, now that's a good investigator. So,
nice. Only one has been Leticia. We love her.
Yeah. The Coco Chanel book is written by Hal Vaughan, something like that. He is an American in France, worked for U.S. Foreign Affairs, then became a journalist. He served in World War II. And the book is based on newly declassified, newly as of like 2000, late 2010s.
Oh, okay. So he wasn't
early 2010s,
anyway.
Late 2000s. Based on newly declassified French and German intelligence material of the war, the book revealed never before been told details of how Coco Chanel served the Abwehr, I guess, as Agent 7124, codenamed Westminster.
Her code name was Westminster?
Yeah.
I feel like there should be like stuff coming out with that on it. That'd be cool.
Imagine a Coco Chanel shirt with the word Westminster.
I know, that's what I'm saying. That'd be like crazy.
I don't know that we would want to make light of her being a Nazi spy, though.
Okay, but she is one, and her stuff is famous anyways.
Right, but...
Could you imagine, like...
That would just be, like, really offensive to people.
Oh, for sure, but...
But isn't it already offensive that she's...
It is. More people need to know about it, for sure.
Yeah, I feel like people
but
don't
I don't think... If people knew it, I don't think people would want to buy, like...
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, going on to the actual story. Brembate di Sopra is...
That's the town where Yara was from.
Yeah. First urbanized by Romans. Ooh. The earliest written records of Brembate date back to 856. literally 856. The village, which takes its name from its proximity to the river Brembo, began to be referred to as Brembate di Sopra, Upper Brembate, to distinguish it from Brembate di Sotto, known simply as Brembate to the south. Mm. Basically, you got like, it's like saying Virginia and then West Virginia.
Got it.
But north. Anyways, the microphone bugged out. Anyways, we're good. It's the finale, so I figured I'd get as many notes as possible. Tangiers, you asked about it. It's a port city in Morocco.
So he was going home.
Yeah, on the Strait of Gibraltar. Now, Stefan's got a...
Yes, fly tipping. I was very curious about what that was. I thought maybe people like snuck out late at night and got into like a farm pasture and tipped over flies. But that is not the case.
Because flies are only found in farm pastures.
It's just my tie to cow tipping. Jan, if you got to dissect my joke, it's not worth it.
Where are all the flies? Well, you're in a freaking open field.
Cow dung does attract flies.
Yeah, where there are cows, there are flies. So,
true.
Anyways, that is not what fly tipping is. Or maybe it is, but there's a different meaning.
Just picturing people going out trying to tip flies.
Yeah, like I don't know how you would pull that off. You have to have some tiny hands, man.
The pros do it with chopsticks.
Oh, yes.
Well, if we really want to know what fly tipping is, it's an illegal deposit of any waste onto land that does not have a license to accept it.
Ah, that makes sense.
So yeah. Littering.
Littering. It's a very fancy term for littering.
Why would they call it that?
Who knows? I guess because you're like tipping off flies with your trash.
Okay, so you know, like you're tipping, so you're throwing something, like you throw a tip at something, and it's flying through the air. Gosh. I'm way too tired to try to come up with it.
Throw all your
tips?
Or
hand their trash to a fly.
Right. No, she's right. It's also known as fly dumping. So it's tipping, but it's flying, literally. So you were right. Look at that, right. Actually.
Great job.
Yeah. I totally know what I'm talking about.
It's the truth.
But also, like, that's what they should call, apparently their new approach to our dumpster is...
Oh my gosh.
Fly tipping. So stupid. Because they're acting like it is not a legal place that accepts trash. That's my... 2 cents. But also, that's really sad because that was like about him finding her body, and I'd feel bad joking about anything related to that. But yeah, that's really sad.
I just heard the term fly tipping and went, "What is that?"
Right. But obviously, that's,
he said he thought it was somebody fly tipping when it was the body.
That's right. Okay. Last thing. Talked about this dude with the multiple affairs would go to spas.
Uh-huh.
So I looked up. This, I think I found the spa.
The exact one?
I think so. And they have a pool, and I need your guys' opinion on it.
No.
Because I can't tell if this is a fun, whimsical take on like a Willy Wonka pool, or if it's a really, really bad 70s strip club.
Oh, it looks grungy.
It's so weird, right?
Yeah. I'm going with the strip club.
I feel like I can smell it, and like not in a good way.
It's disgusting. Yeah. It's like basked in red lighting.
No, I don't like that.
Like a photo development room. And then the water's green.
Ew.
Anyways.
Is it still a thing?
Yeah, it's still open. And rave reviews, let me say.
Oh, my God.
Did you already book your trip?
Yes. The other thing was when I was looking up spas, trying to find the one, there was an article that talked about different spas in that area. And it was like, you know, like when you have like, oh, come visit Florida websites or come visit this state. And it's like the fun things to do in the state. Mm-hmm. It was one of those. And I just wanted to show you guys because this is the picture they chose to showcase another spa. And I was just like, why? Why would you pick this picture?
What in the world?
For the people that are listening, it's literally... like as if the marketing director of the spa went up to the random couple sitting in a way too small little tub and was like, pose for a picture. And the girl is like, oh no, covering her face. And the guy's like, what's up? Friggin' all sprawled out.
Listen, if you email us, we'll send you this picture.
Yes. That is the That'll be our new.
We'll send you a t-shirt with this picture on it.
Like, who does that? Anyways.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Well, great
season
episode.
Season 2, it's a wrap.
Yep.
That's a wrap.
I'm trying to think of all the different episodes we covered in season 2. Because I was going to say my favorite like we did for season 1, but I don't.
Did we say our favorites for season 1?
I think we did. We at the very end, we were like, what was your favorite? I don't know. I think your baseball one was really cool.
That was definitely my favorite.
I think that was really cool. I still remember it, like Melvin Hall. We have a friend that's crazy. A Yankees fan, and I always make fun of him because Melvin Hall.
The episode with the mummies and all the objects that you had that I found. That one was a fun one.
That was cool.
We did a haunted one. That was fun.
That was just fun overall.
I just realized we changed our naming structure halfway through the season.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
That was on purpose.
We're not, like, anything official where we can't just change things around.
Yeah, we're not. It's not like we're going to get in trouble.
Nah.
But anyways, great job, ladies. Good season. Look at us.
Thanks.
Look at you guys.
Good job, guys.
I've only been a part of this for one season.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well.
Thanks for listening, guys, and we will see you next season.